Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway. I think one of my favorite moments so far in the media hysteria that is swooping across the nation as fast and crazy as the virus, the coronavirus is the attempt by the mainstream media to blame the president for this guy in Phoenix that died after drinking aquarium cleaner liquid. Apparently, here's what happened. Business Insider did a piece on this, and there's been multiple media outlets that have written articles that insinuate that the president is at fault for this guy who died. Chloroquine is a very promising potential therapeutic for coronavirus. And when I say therapeutic, that's a very important word because it's not a cure. It's a potential therapeutic, meaning that it could potentially help lessen the severity of the virus for people who are experiencing more severe cases and could potentially help you get better quickly. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence and a lot of new studies coming out showing that it has some positive impact. It's not the end-all be-all, and it's not a cure. I don't remember the president ever saying that it would be a cure, but the president did tout it. And clearly he was talking about the medical form because they use it as a drug to fight malaria. What's interesting is that this particular chemical or product or whatever actually exists in aquarium cleaner. But aquarium cleaner is also poisonous for you. And there's warnings on the bottle. The wife of an Arizona man, according to Business Insider, who died after ingesting chloroquine phosphate to protect himself from the novel coronavirus, urged the public on Monday not to, quote, believe anything that the president says and rely on doctors instead. So the media scoops this up and they're like, I can't remember which, it was some pundit on MSNBC that basically insinuated literally that the president had blood on his hands from this guy. The lady said, "We saw Trump on TV, every channel, and all of his buddies, and that this was safe." The woman said, she's in critical care, by the way, after taking the drug with her husband. Trump kept saying it was basically pretty much a cure. That's not what he said, and the media is irresponsible for reporting that that's what he said. Then the Business Insider article said, quote, the president has repeatedly touted chloroquine as a very powerful treatment against the coronavirus and falsely claimed it was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Again, twisting the president's words. It's approved by the FDA for malaria, is my understanding. And the president is working to get the bureaucracy removed and has done so. And now we're starting to see treatments with that particular drug around the country. So the media now are trying to blame the president and say that the president is at fault for this guy's death because he drank aquarium cleaner. Come on. This is so ridiculous. All right. And then I wanted to play a piece of audio for you because I think this is such a clarifying point about this whole thing. Look, please understand this caveat. This is a fast evolving situation. They're changing things. I have changed my opinion about this virus since the beginning of this whole thing. I think we should be taking it seriously, and we are. Do I think we need to shut down the government and the economy indefinitely? No, absolutely not. I think there need to be benchmarks, as I explained in our last podcast, about how we need to ramp up hospital equipment so that we can actually have the ability to bring in as many people as we need to who are sick. We don't overrun our hospitals. We should have more widespread testing. And once those things are achieved, we need to let healthy young people get back to work. And you could do that in a phased-in way. So let's say May 1st. We set a target date of May 1st. On May 1st, we're going to tentatively reopen for business. And we're going to allow young, healthy people to go back to work as long as their employers test them on a weekly basis and as long as their customer base is separated by 6 feet and they show us the mitigation plan. And if by May 1st we also have an increased hospital capacity, then we're gonna go ahead and start to allow people to go to restaurants as long as they're not seated right next to each other. And we're gonna let retail stores start to open back up so people can buy clothes and go shopping occasionally. But we're going to ask the elderly and the immunocompromised to stay home for another 6 weeks. And then after that, maybe we can start bringing them out. But it would be an incremental thing. What I'm hearing in the media is all or nothing. But there's a lot of numbers being touted that are driving this sort of fear. And I see a lot of, even my friends in the media who aren't quite what I would consider to be left-wing activists, there's a lot of people I know that are just literally, it's like you say something positive. I posted a positive article. There's a Kinza map. Kinza is a brand of digital thermometer, and they collect data. And so when you take your temperature with it, it reports back to them. And they created this app, and they can give you a flash shot of America and how many quote-unquote flu-like illnesses are happening across America. They can't tell the difference between the flu and the coronavirus or some other virus that might give you a fever. But they know a snapshot, a random sample, if you will, of fevers across the country. And guess what? Their fever map is trending down, showing that we're kind of maybe cresting that wave and coming down the backside of the curve in terms of now whether, and by the way, I have the sniffles. It's not coronavirus. It's seasonal allergies. If you have any symptoms at all, go check with your doctor. I'm not going to give you advice on that, but this is seasonal allergies. But so if you hear me sniffling, that's what's going on. But anyway, what's interesting about all of this is that the Kinza map is showing that the number of people with fevers is down across America, even in areas like LA and New York. That's a snapshot. Now, does that mean this thing is over? No, but it's a piece of good news. And I shared it online and people were just poo-pooing this. And I'm like, what? Are you rooting for us to have to stay locked in our homes for an indefinite period of time? So I wanted to bring up something that I'm not hearing anyone talk about in the media, but I happened to catch it. I got in my car the other day, and no, I'm not leaving the house to mingle with people. I leave the house every day to go to a nearby hiking trail, and I hike alone. That is my solace right now. That's my social distancing. I leave the house for an hour or two every day right now, and I go to a hiking trail, and I hike alone for a couple of hours, and it is keeping me sane. But when I leave, you know, I see people moving around, going about their lives. But I got in the car the other day and I was listening to the president's briefing and I heard, great coffee this morning. I think it was Dr. Birx, I think is her name. And I'm just going to play this soundbite for you because I've not heard the media parsing this soundbite. You've heard a lot of people say that 70% of America could be infected. What does that number actually mean and where does it come from and what is the context for it? Listen to this.
I wanted to say one other thing, because you see a lot of numbers out there about 70% of the population is going to get infected or 60% of the population based on those models. Understand that the way you get to that number is you do nothing and it goes through three cycles. So they're talking about this cycle that we're currently in, another cycle in 2021, and a third cycle in 21-22 in order to get that level of population infected. And you know we will have vaccines most likely by the 21-22 season. And we're going to hopefully have therapeutics in the fall of the next season. So the reason we're so much focused on blunting the curve for this piece is if the virus comes back, we'll have much more facility both for diagnosis, testing, monoclonal antibodies, treatments, and then the vaccine.
So what you're really saying is that about 20 to 25% of the population can be infected every year for the next 3 years, not 70% this year. That's very interesting. Now when you break that down and you consider the fact that the vast majority of cases are mild to almost no symptoms at all, then you start to realize very quickly that it's only a certain small segment of the population that's actually going to be super negative affected by this. Now, I'm not going to minimize that because there is an effect on that population. And I want to see what we can do to mitigate that, especially among vulnerable populations. And any plan to reopen for business needs to incorporate a plan to keep those vulnerable populations safe. In fact, for instance, those of you who know me know that I grew up on an Indian reservation. A good friend of mine is involved in government on the Navajo reservation out in northern Arizona, and they are just getting hit hard by this this situation. In fact, he sent me a report this morning that they expect by April 5th, I think it was. Actually, let me look up his text because he told me, here it is, the confirmed cases are growing at a rate of 41% per day. And Arizona is one of the most stringent requirements to even get a test. So just imagine all the people who can't get a test. He said, at this rate, one third of the Navajo Nation will have COVID-19 by April 15th. All of the Navajo Nation would have it by April 19th if mitigation practices aren't observed. And he said, we can't seem to get people to stay at home. The population on that reservation is a vulnerable population. There is a large amount of diabetes and pre-existing conditions that exist in that area. And so we have to think about, in terms of moving forward, when we start to talk about how are we going to open back up for business, we have to make sure that there's vulnerable populations that are taken care of, which is why I've said, when I say I want to see America open back up for business, I'm not saying just carte blanche tomorrow, reopen all the doors. Clearly, this is a serious issue, and clearly it needs to be taken seriously, and we should. That's why I'm calling for more of a plan to be put in place that would say these are the benchmarks. When we reach this capability in testing, we can say to companies, if you agree to test your employees once a week and you agree to show us a mitigation plan to separate your customers by 6 feet or more, then you can reopen once we reach that testing capacity. And once we reach the hospital bed capacity and the PPE protective gear for doctors and nurses capacity, then we can begin to let those people that are older and more susceptible out into into the economy as well. Now, this is how I would design it, but I don't, you know, you bring it up and you're immediately accused of being a virus denier. You know, it's like some people just want us to stay hunched down forever, and I don't think that is, I don't think that's necessarily the way that we should be planning for this, because I do believe that if we stay too long hunkered down, the economic damage will kill far more people than the virus will. All right. One of the legislators in our state legislature here in Kentucky that is actually questioning the paradigm right now is Representative Savannah Maddox. She's gotten a lot of flack for an amendment to a bill that she put forward that would essentially give businesses the ability to potentially push back after this crisis is over on the governor if they feel and can prove that any of his decisions to shut them down was arbitrary or not necessary. It's an interesting topic, and I want to bring on Representative Savannah Maddox onto the program to talk about this and more. Representative Maddox, you have filed a piece. First of all, welcome. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good to talk to you again. Last time we had you on, we were talking about the Second Amendment. I know you're a huge supporter of the Second Amendment. And
yes.
You also are concerned right now about executive power and how it's being used in various states across the country, including Kentucky. And so you have essentially attempted to alter a bill that would change the scope of Governor Beshear's executive power. Explain to me what you're doing there.
Yes. Amendment 3 to House Bill 322, it seeks to ensure that the rights of hardworking Kentuckians and business owners are protected from government overreach, essentially. And although this amendment does not interfere with the executive branch's ability, per se, to issue executive orders, pertaining to a state of emergency in particular, because that's what we're all talking about right now with COVID-19, it provides due remedy of law through a system of checks and balances, which are designed to keep our government accountable for any action, which is, you know, of course, determined in a court of law if it infringes upon our civil liberty or unnecessarily restricts commerce. And
so what your bill would do is allow, say, a small business owner who feels unduly harmed by a governor's executive order to be able to sue the state?
Yes. And of course, businesses can already bring a cause of action against the state. And, you know, my purpose in filing this amendment was not to criticize or to undermine the governor's efforts, but rather to ensure that any use of government force is appropriately balanced with the consent of the governed in accordance with our constitutional rights. And, you know, I think that this is really important to do this at this time, simply because this bill isn't only about what's happening now. In less than a month, we're going to adjourn. The General Assembly is going to adjourn. And at that point, Governor Beshear can do even more, you know, perhaps things that are more objectionable and harmful than even is being done now. And the legislature can't do anything about it. And I'm hopeful that at bare minimum, this legislation will cause the governor to rethink his existing order, shutting down businesses and other groups. I mean, at the bare minimum, that's what we're hoping to accomplish here. And I think that it is important, because when we're talking about the due remedy of law, this is essentially another way of saying economic due process.
Is there a specific order that the governor has made that you disagree with, that you think maybe was a particular overreach of not necessarily his power, but an overreach in this situation?
Well, I think that it all ends up and is predicated upon the economic damage that we will receive as a result of the orders, because I agree with the governor, with our president, and a whole host of physicians and public health officials on the state and federal level about the importance of preventing the spread of coronavirus. And, you know, I do want to be adamant that we should all be willing to abide by the public health precautions and recommendations that have been set forth. But we have to bear in mind that we cannot allow these consequences to become worse than the virus itself. And I think that we have an obligation to look out for others and to approach this crisis in a way that mitigates the risk of spreading the disease, but also doesn't result in unnecessary economic hardship.
I have been kind of pounding my drum saying, hey, we need the governor to establish some sort of economic panel that would begin to look at how do we pull out of this. You know, the president made his comments that earlier this week that he wanted to try to open back up for business by Easter. That might be a little bit too soon, but you know, the president sets big goals and then you move toward them. And if you get there 2 weeks later, that's cool. But the point is, there's a recognition that, as you said, I've said this before, if we're not careful, the economic devastation that arises out of this will kill far more people than this virus ever will. And so I'm asking the governor to put benchmarks in place, like these two benchmarks. Once we have widespread testing so that we could say to businesses, look, if you can test your employees once a week, you can open back up, show us your plan to keep your customers 6 feet apart. And then second benchmark would be, we have hospital capacity that's, you know, we have enough beds and respirators for, you know, X number. And once those two things are met, then we can start to phase back in younger and healthier people and then bring maybe elderly people back out of the quarantine and immunocompromised people back out of the quarantine 6 or 8 weeks later. Now, I'm hoping the governor is open to starting to think about that, because we can't just keep hunkering down forever.
Absolutely. And, you know, to your point, Leland, in a lot of cases, businesses were closed without even thinking about whether it had to happen or if something less restrictive could have been done. For instance, you know, you take chiropractors, physical therapists, optometrists, dentists, you know, that's critical care for some patients, and they're all closed. I mean, could they reopen by wearing masks or, you know, other type of PPE, disinfecting and taking appointments without causing a public risk? And I think that these benchmarks that you're referring to could be a very integral part of that process. And, you know, in my time in the legislature as a state representative, I've made it my mission to stand for life, liberty, and property. And no matter what happens, you know, I can't in good conscience stand by and watch the economy fail, businesses fold, and citizens lose their jobs.
Right.
I mean, we have to have a balanced approach.
We saw the employment numbers come out today, and 3.3 million people, which is a record since 1982, basically declaring for unemployment. I think that should shock a lot of people. I mean, I think we all knew that was coming, but to see the reality of that many people now without jobs, And if you keep people locked down, eventually they're going to run out of money to go to the store every morning and buy all the eggs and toilet paper. And when that happens, desperation's going to set in. I fear violence and unrest down the road. If this keeps going without our leaders giving us some sense of hope, even if you don't make that date, if you say by May 1st, we expect to be here if we meet these benchmarks. And if we don't, then you go back and you say to the people, look, we need another couple weeks. Everybody stay home. That's fine. But give people that hope and give businesses that hope that they can weather this.
Absolutely. And, you know, as public health officials continue to work to ensure that our doctors, nurses, first responders, and everyone that's involved here, you know, that they are not disproportionately impacted by this. They're trying to mitigate the risk of the spread and address COVID-19. You know, I'm going to be watching the numbers so that I can work and do my job to restore and be proactive about our economy and to recover a lot that's been lost. And, you know, I'm hopeful. And I know that this has been something that's been very controversial because a lot of folks are saying, you know, why now? Why would you do this? But I think that these are questions that we should all be asking because it is, this crisis is twofold. Yes, it is a legitimate public health concern, but it also is going to attenuate to an economic crisis. So I think we need to be vigilant about that.
Well, I argued the other day that, you know, when in World War II, we fought a war on two fronts. And a lot of our politicians are likening this to World War II. And then we ought to be able to fight a war on two fronts. And we ought to be able to recognize that one front is the virus itself. And another front is the economy. And if we're not prepared to battle both of those at the same time, I think we're being irresponsible.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. And, you know, there are aspects of this that I do find concerning. Obviously, there was a hotline that was created just a few days ago to enable folks to report other citizens. And I think that that's ultimately going to create a scenario in our communities where people are feeling animosity.
Yeah.
Business owners are going to be targeted. You know, say they are just there doing inventory or doing something along those lines, and they are exercising proper social distancing. You know,
right.
they receive that phone call. I think that there are going to be a lot of unintended consequences. And I marvel, frankly, that more people aren't thinking along these lines.
Yeah, it concerns me that there seem to be a large number of people that are perfectly happy to not question this. And again, I don't actually question it for right now. I think we're in a period where at least until the middle of April, we probably need to stay home. You know, we need to not be out running around and be around people. But again, we're also seeing at the same time, you know, this mayor of Chicago said, don't go on long bike rides or long runs or else we'll arrest you. You know, I mean, the mayor of Los Angeles let 1,700 criminals out of jail and then shut down gun stores saying that self-defense wasn't an essential thing. So we're going to have an overtaxed police force. And people can't defend themselves. We're seeing little instances of very authoritarian actions. And it bothers me that that doesn't seem to alarm as many people as it probably should.
Well, and fear is an incredibly motivating factor. And we are all right to be mindful of this and to take it very seriously. You know, again, I just want to reiterate that, like you said, we should be staying home. We should have the moral imperative to look out for others in our community and to take the precautions that the CDC has recommended. But at the same time, we have to keep look at the macro scale of what's being done at the federal level and state level and how it could impact our lives, not just today, but next week and next month. And, you know, in November, some of the folks that, you know, have had a very preemptive voice among the healthcare community have said that we need to keep our nation shut down until November.
Wow.
And I cannot fathom what our economy would look like if we did that.
No,
I mean,
we'd be done. America would be finished. Like literally the Republic would be over. There would be an absolute total economic collapse. Pandemonium, chaos, anarchy would reign the day, and you would not recognize this place. Not at all. And I can't, that's one of my problems with this too, is like, look, I know the epidemiologists and the doctors and the scientists, a lot of whom, by the way, are more in line with what you're talking about, that we've got to make sure we fight this on two fronts. But some of the ones that have got the ear of the leaders, it's like they're alarmist to the farthest end. And I'm like, you've got to have somebody representing both sides of this. Where are the economic alarmists? You know what I mean? Because that is deadly when we're talking about absolute you know, chaos and anarchy and loss of rule of law. That is deadly. And I don't think people realize that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And, you know, it has been somewhat of a controversial time to be talking about issues like this. And, you know, frankly, I feel that I am among the first and few who have engaged this issue in this way. And, you know, I've received a certain level of criticism and scrutiny because folks are so afraid of this being politicized. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think that it matters. This isn't a function of party lines or anything of that nature. We all need to be vigilant, not only about the public health concerns, but about protecting our individual liberties and our way of life and holding our government accountable. That's never wrong to hold the government accountable for their actions, I don't think.
What are you hearing from your own constituents?
My constituents here in the 61st, which includes Grants, portions of Boone, Kenton, and Scott County, have been very receptive and positive for the most part. I have had quite a large amount of dissent from some folks, fewer in my district than in other parts of the state. Out of Jefferson County and Fayette County, there has been quite a large amount of dissent because, first of all, this amendment was mischaracterized on social media a few days back, saying that the amendment sought to strip the governor of his powers, which, of course, is not what it seeks to do at all. And in fact, it is it does not remove the powers that he has to issue these executive orders. So, I mean, among my colleagues, we have been out of Frankfort and we'll just be reconvening for the first time in a week today. But, you know, something that's interesting, Leland, is that through looking at this amendment, this is the first time that a lot of folks have seen the powers that the governor does have in statute during a state of emergency, the things that he's capable of doing, he or she, at any time in the future.
Yeah. I hope that the lesson we take from this, you know, the other day, Governor Holcomb of Indiana said the Indiana State Police are going to be out patrolling and, you know, they might put, you know, they might contact you and ask you why you're out. So you might have to actually explain to authorities that you're going to the grocery store to get a gallon of milk, assuming one's available. And I'm like, you know, if anything good comes out of this, maybe it's the fact that we're going to get a firsthand look of what a authoritarian police state, even if it's necessary for the right time being. Right. I mean, even if right now that's necessary and I get that, but at least we're going to get a firsthand look at what that looks like. And maybe that'll help us to limit it going forward once we're through this crisis.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think that, again, this is the first time that, you know, in our statute, and I'll just very briefly kind of breeze over this, but the ability to seize stocks of fuel, food, clothing, equipment, materials, medicines, all supplies, facilities, you know, some of these powers that I don't think that folks were aware of. And, you know, my intent with this amendment was certainly not to change that at this moment in time, but it is a conversation that we need to have, you know, to what level do we allow the government to be able to interfere in our lives this way and deprive us of our life, liberty, and property under these circumstances? And more importantly, if it is determined that they have the authority and power to do that, what recourse do we have as citizens and as businesses? What is our remedy of law? And that's kind of what this was all about.
Yeah, it makes sense. Very interesting. Well, hopefully we can get through this. I do want to reiterate, I think people should stay at home. I also think that the governor's heart's in the right place. I think he is.
Yes.
I think he is trying to save Kentucky lives. I don't question that or his motives at all. But I do want him to start thinking about the way forward. I do want him to start thinking about the path forward economically. And I think it's good that there are legislators like yourself that are raising questions like this so that we have these conversations. And maybe, like I said, it gives us a snapshot and we start to think, wait a minute, how are we going to protect ourselves in the future from somebody potentially abusing these powers? Which, again, I'm not accusing the governor of doing that, but in the future, you know, you're always one election away from somebody who would abuse it. And as I pointed out, I think there are people around the country that are abusing those powers. So I think it's good to highlight that. Representative Maddox, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Leland.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. So look, she's bringing up a conversation. These are questions that have to be asked. One thing that I hope that comes out of this, and she agreed with me and I said it at the get, I'm not questioning the governor's motives in this, nor am I even questioning any of his particular moves at this point. I do believe that he has the state's best interest in mind. I believe that he's trying to save lives. I want him to open his mind to the economic future. I really want him to do that. But
all around America, we're seeing examples of some executive leaders that are taking advantage and they are going way overboard. Like I mentioned to Savannah, the Chicago mayor that's like, we'll arrest you if you take too long of a bike ride. Well, how do you define a long bike ride? I mean, they told people that they could go outside and exercise, but they're telling people not to exercise too long. Well, how do I know what's too long? Who's policing that? State of Indiana, Indiana State Police is going to maybe help enforce this. We have a hotline now in Kentucky that you can call. I mean, these are things that you do in a dystopian state. And it's like, do we really want this to be, you know, the new normal when we have an emergency? And again, we've got to do the mitigation. You have to stay home, people. You have to stay home. Go outside to exercise, get your groceries, and get back in the house. And let's do this for at least 2, maybe 3 weeks. And we'll start to save some lives and see some differences in this thing. But you have to have these questions about liberty and freedom and the scope and power of the government. And then how much disruption is too much disruption? Well, I'll tell you what. There's never too much disruption, though. Thanks for listening. We've got a fun episode coming up tomorrow. Christian Toto, who is a Hollywood critic from a conservative point of view, is going to join us, and he is going to obliterate the media in all of this. You're going to love that episode. The best thing you can do for me is share these episodes, share this podcast. You can download it on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Subscriptions are totally free. You can also get it on iHeartRadio's app. That's a new one. We're now on the iHeartRadio app, and we're loving it. So if you have the iHeartRadio app, just search the Disruption Zone in the podcast section, and you will find us there. We're also on Spreaker. Wherever podcasts are found, you can find us. On Twitter, it's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And on Instagram, it's at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks to our partners, my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills. Thanks again to Dynamics Productions for their help on the production side of this program, dxaudio.com for more information there. And thanks for listening. I am Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.